Welcome to The Quantum Pod, a podcast by Zapata. In this episode, I talked with the people behind the IQT conference to learn where quantum computing has been and where it's going. All right, I am here in the Quantum Pod with Christopher Bishop, who is the Master of Ceremonies for Inside Quantum Technology, and Lawrence Gassman, who is the President of IQT. Both of you, thanks for coming on the Quantum Pod.
Delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
Yeah, so before we jump into, because you guys just got off a breakneck 5-day Inside Quantum Technologies conference that we want to talk all about. Before we do that, describe to us, what does your quantum pod look like? Let's start with you, Lawrence.
I don't know much about quantum pods. This is definitely a question which Chris can give a better answer to, I think.
Well, so I would say my quantum pod is me in a workspace. So maybe a conference room with whiteboards. But the key is I'm surrounded by people with skills in a whole range of disciplines, right? So certainly there's a particle physicist, but there's also a person who's running communications. There's someone who's providing strategic business guidance. There's someone maybe who has an investment direction perspective. There's a couple of program managers / project managers. There's a user-centered design person. There's someone focused on regulatory and policy issues. So that's sort of my view of my quantum pod.
And I want to ask, is it very quiet? Is it a library atmosphere, or is it hustle and bustle? Everyone's around talking and working.
Everyone is working. They're talking. They're interacting. Some of them have VR headsets on. Some of them are located in different parts of the world. There's a team on Mars, actually, that's working on installing a quantum computer in the colony there at Muskville. There's a team that's mining an asteroid, and they have a perspective that they want to share. They're using Lawrence's desktop quantum computer on the asteroid.
All right, far out.
The Gassman. They call it the Gassman, actually, is the name of that desktop quantum computer. Named after a brilliant leader in the space, you know, who was one of the first to postulate that this might be a possibility.
Which got very bad reception, by the way.
No, really? Yeah.
Well, I think it did, yes, seriously.
I thought it was great.
I got an amazing number of nice things on LinkedIn this weekend, and I felt almost embarrassed by how nice they were. Not a person mentioned my talk, just my arranging skills, so I'm thinking I didn't get the point across well. But anyway, about small quantum computers. So
I thought it was great. Yeah, I mean, well, again, it's whenever you're pushing the envelope, people don't quite know how to react, and that's what you were doing. So that's my take on it anyway.
Well, thank you. And I push the envelope rather a lot in all sorts of things. So and I like doing that, but you can't expect everybody to watch nod up and down, and they didn't. But I will continue.
It sounds like on the whole, though, the Inside Quantum Technology conference went very well.
It did.
You want to tell us a bit more about? Maybe let's start with, what are your top three, your takeaways from organizing this IQT conference?
Where to start? I mean, it was certainly the biggest conference that has ever been held anywhere at any time on quantum technology in terms of the length of the conference. I don't think there's been a 5-day conference. And that's with a business orientation. There's been technical conferences for many years on very specific things. May have taken 5 days, I don't know. The second thing is really just listening to people, how far we've come from, I mean, 18 months ago, certainly 2 years ago, it was possible to get published in a respectable journal or popular magazine saying, I don't know about this quantum technology stuff. It all sounds a bit BS-y to me, and I don't think this is really going to happen. And there were articles in respectable magazines by respectable engineers explaining why it couldn't happen. But it is happening, so that's a big leap forward. I'd say the second thing is that what we're seeing now is quantum technology as a whole splitting off into different fields at very different levels of commercial development. So quantum safe, meaning encryption, and quantum random generation, quantum key distribution, is a real industry. There's lots of companies in it, a small number actually shipping stuff, people writing checks, sometimes big checks for it. We'll be running a separate conference on that, by the way, in 2022, actually, later 2022, in DC. I think the second thing in that light is quantum computing, which is what people always think about. It's a separate area. It's evolving fast, in a way, not fast enough. And everything else is sort of in between, and unless you want a very detailed answer. So it's a bifurcation, I think. And also, how many big organizations back at the end user end are beginning to, you know, wind down that trail towards actually using quantum computers? Still a long way to go. One of my ambitions was with this conference was always to have end users speak, which was very hard the very first time we did it because there weren't any end users. So very hard to recruit them. And some of them were not going to be recruited. Like, certainly one of the first users of quantum computers was the intelligence community. And we actually had the intelligence community this time.
Yes.
But that's new. And certainly at the beginning, they weren't all that thrilled about being part of public conferences for obvious reasons.
Yeah. You mentioned that quantum technology, specifically quantum computing, in some ways hasn't been developing fast enough. Would you maybe elaborate a little bit more on that and maybe talk about how you see we can make it go faster?
Well, it's really, really hard. That's the. I mean, we don't quite know how to do it yet. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but it's not much of one. One sign of an immature technology is, or immature field, is how many technologies are competing with each other. I mean, we don't spend a lot of time talking about chips other than silicon chips, except in specialized applications like with optoelectronics. It's silicon all the way. I haven't counted, but we must have 9 different competing technologies in quantum. But they're all very, very different. It's not. And they all have their advantages in terms of speed. They have their advantage, and that's speed compared with other quantum technologies. It's not compared with classical computers. They have their advantage in whether they can operate at room temperature. All those pretty chandelier thingies from IBM and others, gold chandeliers. I mean, that's always impressive. Gold chandeliers are always going to be impressive. But, and this is Chris's point about my completely hypothetical desktop computer, is that you can't have a desktop computer which has a giant golden chandelier with $1 million on it.
Well, so I would say that the obviously everything Lawrence said was exactly right. I think the interoperability between quantum solutions was kind of striking. So, you know, talk of say using quantum networks, which I think more historically, although 2 years is historically, have been talked about as sort of standalone, secure, immutable networks, are being talked about as a way to connect clustering, for example, quantum computers, as well as maybe metropolitan communication, where they might first be adopted, and leveraging technologies across solutions. I also think it's, I liken it to, I'm sort of a fan of the history of economic thought, right? So I liken it to the evolution of other technologies, even like the railroad. So when the railroad first came out, it was like, which, you know, what should be the track width? How long should the cars be? Where are they going to deliver? Are they going to deliver people or just goods or both? Or so there's, this is a pattern that's been going on for probably 350 years where there's an innovative technology and then there's some kind of reconciliation, lots of discussion around standards and applications. And then ultimately, you know, one or two maybe standards or approaches get codified and implemented and deployed and adopted. And that's kind of how the technology moves forward. So for me, I think we're sort of in that stage with quantum, right? Which is very exciting, actually, but also the Wild West.
Within this Wild West of quantum, you as an enterprise customer want to have the best chance of exploring successfully. How do you do that? Well, the same way you'd explore the actual Wild West, by having a good guide and the right tools. Heading out into the unknown with seasoned explorers like us at Zapata will reduce your chances of getting lost, backtracking, or finding pitfalls the hard way. Additionally, you wouldn't want to bring a pogo stick to explore the Wild West. Having the right tools to explore with is important. That's why we've built Orchestra to be our trusty steed, helping us to explore more efficiently.
It's very much the Wild West. And some of the people are, too.
Indeed.
I have to say that the people I know from my 4 years, 5 years in quantum are some of the nicest people you'd like to meet and also some of the most brilliant. As Chris knows, I have involvements with other technologies, nothing to do with quantum. And they're very different worlds and very different people. You should expect, not at our conferences, to be honest, not at other people's too, some pretty creepy people getting into quantum and making claims that they can't make. That has not yet happened, but I've seen it happen. And often with a lot of money behind them too. So that's one issue. I think people will make claims that they can't possibly justify. And we're beginning to see this. I think that some VCs and some people behind this in finance are growing a little skeptical because they're being told things that aren't happening. Expect about two more years, expect 2 years of quiet. That doesn't mean that important things aren't happening, but we may have got over the fuss and the drama and everything else. And that's both a good thing and a bad thing. If you're trying to get money for a quantum startup and you're just starting out, I think that's much harder to get now. We heard this actually than it used to be. If you're a large company, then you might progress towards, you'll find money because people trust you from 200 years of experience in technology. And of course you have your own internal money in those cases. And you don't need immediate results. But I think it's harder to do a quantum computing startup. And if it is a quantum computing startup, you need a lot of money. It's not like a sensor startup or something.
I just want to follow on what Lawrence was saying, is that I think, to his point, the community is very supportive and excited and optimistic at a meta level. I mean, it's something new with incredible potential to help us live and work better and solve problems that have historically been intractable. And so that kind of energy and enthusiasm, I think, infuses the events. Certainly it did ours last week. I mean, people were excited to be there and to join remotely and talk about this this new technology. So it was cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Although, Chris, do you see the same thing that Lawrence was talking about with this, potentially 2 years of not necessarily a quantum winter. That's what everyone's afraid of. But right. Just 2 years is of a slowdown. I wouldn't necessarily classify that as quantum winter. Do you see that?
I don't. I think it's, again, back to my, economic historian with my economic historian hat on. nation technologies get adopted incrementally, right? It's never somebody flips a switch and suddenly we're all riding around in Model Ts. I mean, that sort of did happen a little bit, but it's like there'll be viable use cases that will emerge in different verticals, different industries, and they'll get applied and tested. It'll be skunk works at big companies. It'll be scrappy startups that are putting together solutions. And, you know, over time, use cases that deliver value will emerge. And we're, as Lauren said, we're already starting to see it in quantum safe. I mean, that's really, you could call that a viable business. Are there companies that have clients and that are selling in solutions? You know, quantum computing, probably 3 to 5 years, maybe. I mean, although JP Morgan and even Goldman have, you know, research organizations that are very aggressively pursuing how quantum might deliver on value for financial services clients. So I think it's, you know, it's going to be dribs and drabs, starts and stops, but heading in the right direction, heading in a positive direction.
I think for sure, I think there's the evidence Chris said is true. I think a couple of things that play a role in this. One is advocates of quantum technology at the end user. If we talk about banks, and you were, it's very typical in banks who adopt new technologies for there to be one advocate who just, you know, is the industry guy and he goes out and talks about it. And you're certainly seeing that in banks with quantum now. And as Chris hinted at, banks are going out and spending a lot of money on finding advocates in the sense. So I think that's a big deal.
Another aspect that Lawrence sees as very important is government funding, especially
because it's so tied into the defense considerations, especially around China.
What does this mean for the field moving forward? Well,
government money will be there.
I mean, it's almost, you know, we could liken it to DARPA even, right? So developing the internet, that's the sort of public sector, private sector partnership. I mean, and with universities, sort of the triumvirate, if you will, academia and government and private sector working together for mutual benefit. I mean, we're seeing a lot of funding, certainly in the U.S., but also in Europe. I mean, I think the Netherlands got like 625 million euros allocated to advancing quantum and AI and machine learning related technologies. Germany has a big initiative. In the U.K., we're seeing it. Focus in Australia. So that's a good thing because they have money and they understand the value of it. And, you know, encouraging it and supporting it and underwriting it. So that's great.
And that was exactly what I was going to say. You know, I'm obviously a great deal older than you are, but I remember how everything was tied to NATO and DARPA and all the things that were essentially facing the enemy, which was the Russians back then. And even things that had nothing to do, obviously, with it. I went to my background's mathematics, and I went to a conference in 1971 on function theory. You don't know what function theory is, but it's important, and I won't explain it. But it was funded by NATO for no obvious reason, other than they wanted to bring in good mathematicians and things. So, I mean, it's easy to see how this would be the next thing. And of course, it's part of a bigger thing. It's part of machine learning and AI, obviously. All three of those things are very tied together.
So on the topic of the conference, you are bringing a lot of these different industries, people from academia as well together. Curious, what was the atmosphere in the room like? Or a virtual room, maybe.
Yeah, I was going to say we had, this is where Chris came in just now. I've forgotten how many countries we had. 40 countries, I believe. Is that right? Something like that.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
I think the afternoon was a lot of excitement. Terrible thing for a conference organizer to say, but in some ways the measure of it is the people who don't go into the talks and are sitting outside talking to each other is one measure of it. So I think a lot of people were very excited. I mean, the people who were there were people who expect to make a lot of money from this, people who expect to have intellectual stimulation, and people who expect it to make changes in society. And this is all very near now. The first time I ever heard of a quantum computer was on a very theoretical conference that actually, oddly enough, I was also involved in organizing, but where they talked about new developments in quantum computing 30 years ago. They talked about new developments in computing, and quantum computing was one of them. But, you know, I mean, I can think of weird things that might exist in another 30 years. Who knows? I'll be 102 then, by the way. So I'm not anticipating, actually, well, maybe I will know. But you know what I mean. 30 years is 30 years. It's quite a long time. And I don't think anybody really thought this. And some of the possibilities they talked about then just never happened. So it's fascinating to see this. And it is happening. And that's part of the excitement.
Yeah, we did have Worley speak. So he's sort of he's a legendary thinker, somewhat the gadfly or the voice of reason, if you will. And he gave a very compelling talk, I think the net of which was that we need to be cautious about the hype. And I've heard Christopher Savoy, CEO of Zapata, say the same kind of thing. You know, hype is the enemy to some degree. We have to be realistic about what's coming and when. So it's sort of the challenge is blending enthusiasm with realism, if you will. But I think overall, to echo Lawrence, I mean, people were excited to be, you know, in the same space for sure, virtually as well as physically, and talking about this new technology.
And that's precisely right. You do have to blend enthusiasm with realism. Otherwise, the money runs out and people stop believing you. On the other hand, you really can't be too, you know, hypercritical. If you go around saying things like, I don't know, this quantum computing thing, it hasn't got very far and I haven't really seen it. I mean, you know, it'll never replace like real computing. You break the golden egg, I suppose, in many ways. I mean, everybody gets that it isn't here yet. Nobody said we're going to have a powerful quantum computing machine in 1 year's time. Nobody believes that. And if you go around saying that.
Yeah. Something that I've noticed on the subject of hype is maybe the biggest problem is people just don't have the education. They aren't aware of the challenges that quantum computing is faced with and where the field actually is. So I think that this conference that brings together the people who know that and the people who need to know that is such a great thing.
Well, I think that's true. I'm not sure how much conferences like ours really change that. Because it's not a technology that people outside our little community spend a lot of time thinking about. It's interesting because I've seen some data on this from, what's his name, Koenig, one of the guys who spoke at the conference, Andre Koenig. Who looked at sort of general news press, and there wasn't that much in there about quantum computing, and it hadn't increased in the last year at all. And that's a little different from how mobile computing or mobile phones kind of went, because everybody had one of those, and nobody at the moment is going to have a quantum computer would know what to do. I mean, they would cost millions and millions of dollars, so nobody has them, but if they suddenly got shipped, no one would know how to program them. And if they knew that, they wouldn't know what to do to program them for, because they deal with very complex issues. I mean, what one person pointed out to me is quantum computers help a lot with certain kinds of problems. So if you tell a quantum computer to add one and one, you get, you know, 1.9734, because there's statistical machines and quantum theory is a statistical theory. So, you know, if I was, even if I really did have a tiny little quantum computing adding things up at the supermarket, it would not help with.
So another thing I wanted to ask is if you learned anything new from the conference, any maybe big announcements, anything that you think that listeners would like to know about?
You know, I'm so on top of it most of the time that there wasn't any real surprises. And, you know, it goes back to this. We've reached a stage where we're going to have to do a lot of hard work before we come out with spectacular things. And you can, you know, at the forefront of this whole industry was Google and Microsoft. They got, it seemed like there was an article about them in A Quantum every day of the week, and they've gone very quiet, except when you actually do a bit of a Google and look at what they're doing, they're not quiet at all. They're doing a lot of work on, you know, boring stuff, except it isn't boring because we'll never get to the new exciting bit before they do the boring stuff. So it's becoming a real research field. Of course, that's great. It's just not very newsworthy. And I think that just became more apparent than ever just listening to people talk. But, you know, we are moving forward.
Well, so I would say the one thing that struck me was, you know, the ongoing conversation around how to measure the power of these devices, right? Certainly quantum computers. So IBM announced, I don't know if they'd done it before, but they shared Bob Suter, who's a colleague and sort of the lead quantum exponent at IBM Research, mm-hmm. introduced something called CLOPS, right, as a way to measure the power of computers. So they introduced other criteria for how you determine, you know, quantum advantage was this, as Lawrence was saying, you know, the benchmark that supposedly Google achieved and then IBM refuted them. But they have something now called CLOPS. I'm trying to look up what it stands for, but it's a new
metric.
Don't
ask me, I can't remember. But
circuit layer operations per second.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. So a new, you know, metric to measure the speed of a quantum computer. CLOPS, I'm reading from the website. It's the first of its kind to measure the number of quantum circuits that a quantum processing unit, QPU, can execute in a unit of time. So interesting. Again, as we try to figure out how to, you know, manage and standardize and measure the power of these devices, and IBM has been at the forefront of, you know, quantum volume. That's what it was. That was their previous way to measure, and this they've sort of taken it yet another level, which is great coming from IBM Research because they know how to do this, and they, you know, they win the every year they win the award for the most patents by a private sector company or whatever. I mean, and have for like 25 years. So, although they're saying they have a lot of brain power to marshal against how to measure and manage functions within a quantum computer. So that was new to me. I hadn't heard that before.
In case you needed another example of why we're still in the Wild West era of quantum computing, like Chris was saying, we're still working out how to measure the performance of quantum computers. IBM has quantum volume and now CLOPS, and IonQ has algorithmic qubits, and we still don't have a straight answer to what is the most powerful quantum computer today. Again, Orchestra sees this as an opportunity, because we make it very easy to swap out backends across hardware providers, allowing for better performance for your algorithms as quantum computers continue to improve. Okay, I wanted to ask, this isn't IQT's first rodeo, as you were talking about. You've been doing this for 4 or 5 conferences now?
Yeah, something like that. Apparently we don't remember.
I think you're right, Lawrence. I think it might be 5.
I think we're on to anyway. That was 5.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, this is number 5. I'm curious, what has been like common themes that you've seen over this one and the last 4 that have stayed the same?
Stayed the same. There's not much that stayed the same that's truly interesting. One of them is the division and the productization haven't changed. So if you looked at it when we were beginning, which I did, and you were looking at, you know, what are the ultimate products, they were quantum computers. Quantum safe which was very much about QKD, and that may have been actually the first product of any kind. I mean, what caused the people who formed IQT to form IQT was something I'd written on QKD a year previously, and it was already a market of sorts. QRNGs were also being sold back then, but all the same terminology, nothing completely new has jumped out. Quantum sensors actually meant something a little different, but still a continuity. And quantum networking, well, nobody quite knew what that meant, but it was clear just from, you know, from data communications that, you know, it was going to have to be something like quantum networking. And so that stayed very much the same. Some of the players are identical too. I mean, you wonder whether that will stay that way much longer, but it certainly is true now.
Anything that you've noticed that's seemed to be a similar theme, Chris, over the years?
Well, as Lars was saying, I mean, sort of the main players are still the main players. And there's a whole sort of coterie of startups and ancillary and adjacent businesses that are, you know, that are still providing niche solutions that, and getting traction and getting clients. So I think, yeah, that's been the same for the past few years, for sure.
I mean, a few people have dropped out or not pursued their. I can think of one startup that I knew quite well, but there's probably others. For a brief while, Oracle was in this space, which something it inherited from Sun, and that seems to have gone away. HP had something going. It had a machine called the Machine. And then when they split into two companies, the machine stopped, I guess. It disappeared. There are other companies like that. I thought of another one a minute ago.
I think what's exciting, just to shift gears, is to talk about what's changed, right? And that's really interesting. Certainly, you know, I would go on record as saying hybrid is the new model, as Lawrence was implying before. You know, we're not going back to just meeting as carbon-based life forms in a physical space. You know, that's going to be one aspect of how we conduct events and interact, but it's certainly not going to be the de facto standard anymore. I mean, we ran this event as a hybrid in a physical space in New York and then broadcast it all over the world for 5 days from 8 to 5 and had terrific uptake and participation.
Yeah, it's funny, Chris, when you said hybrid is the new model, I thought of hybrid quantum computing.
That too. I mean, again, that's another topic that is sort of discussed, but not maybe as blatantly as it might, is the amount of classical computing that's required to make quantum work, right? Actually, Christopher Savoy mentioned that in my podcast with him, and I know he's a firm believer in that as being, you know, the 800-pound gorilla or the elephant in the room or whatever you want to describe it. But there is a lot of classical compute power and memory that's required to make this thing go, and it gets sort of mentioned, you know, in passing, but is an important topic for sure.
Yeah, as we move forward, maybe in future conferences, are there any trends that you expect to continue going forward in quantum computing?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, all of them. on the encryption side, on the quantum safe side, I mean, that's now become so well established, but so many things to do. If you look at PQC, which is going to become increasingly necessary throughout the IT world, we still don't really have the standards yet. And I think most people think that when we're done with this layer of standards, we're going to have a lot more. You know, we aren't all going to have QKD, but for QKD, it's going to be smaller and smaller chips, so the price of these things and you'll see the number of things you can put a QKD chip into scale up dramatically, so that, you know, the revenue keeps reasonably stable. So all that will continue. The power of quantum computers will go up. However, you know, whichever IBM measure you decide to use to measure that, and you know, quantum volume is an amazing leap forward because it's so simple and captures so many things. It's not a piece of genius work of mathematics, because it's the way that mathematicians and physicists have been measuring things, the way that they've been doing it. There's, you know, what I think the final thing is, you know, as I mentioned, when we had our first conference, I wanted to get end users, but there weren't any, so it was hard to find them. And we did have them, and they did exist.
They both showed up.
Well, you know, without D-Wave, I mean, if you decide that D-Wave is not a quantum computer, you'd be pretty close to it for the time of our first conference, and then IBM came in with lots of end users. Because a lot of those end users are research facilities, and that doesn't quite count. I mean, it does count, but it doesn't quite count. So, I mean, all those things have changed, and I expect, you know, if you talk to the banks, which we did, when we did for our studies, but also for, you know, for conferences, certainly 5 years from now, you'll be having the kind of boring conversations that people with big computers have about actually implementing these things and all they can do. And you could probably have a conference on quantum computing in banking or something, and bankers would mostly turn up. So, I mean, things are changing. They're following the same patterns, though, that, you know, we have in computing for a very long time.
So I would just say, so from a meta perspective, I liken it to early days of the internet, if you will, back to historical economic models, right? We people didn't know what people were going to do with the web, right? What are we going to do with this thing? Is it going to drive business models? Or are we just going to click endlessly down the rabbit hole of HTML link, hyperlinks? And so, you know, I think that's a common theme. People are like, you know, where will this go? That said, one takeaway for me, I'm focused on workforce development, right? Being a nonlinear multimodal careerist myself, but talking to, for example, execs from Quantum Exchange, and they don't hire physicists. They hire cryptology experts or cybersecurity resources. And they also hire people to provide guidance around data sort of analysis, like what data is, you know, precious to you? What data do you need to protect now and in the future across your business, across your supply chain, across your interaction with business partners? So that's a whole new job, quote unquote. That's a whole new career, right? Advising businesses, large enterprise, on what data is important and how to protect it and, you know, where to put it and what to do with it and how to collect it and manage it. So that was interesting to me, just as a model for new opportunities for jobs and careers and ultimately business models that generate attributable revenue, right?
Very interesting. Well, this has been an excellent conversation. Lawrence and Chris, thank you both for coming into the Quantum Pod.
Well, it's been great to be here. Thanks for inviting us to join you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And I hope the people who get to listen to this enjoyed as much as I did being part of it. So thank you again. And thank you for your company's involvement in our show. It was quite important. So thank you.
Absolutely. Now I can shuffle out of the room with all the varied physicists and business leaders and shut off the lights.
Yeah. Okay. Well, great meeting you.
I hope you've enjoyed this recap of the Inside Quantum Technology Conference. Even though we're currently in the wild, wild west of quantum computing, people who've been watching this space for a while expect developments to continue, even if they're just hard work background things instead of super exciting public-facing things. If you found this episode interesting, share this podcast with the hashtag #QuantumPod and tell us what you liked about it. Be sure to like the podcast wherever you listen to it, subscribe, and maybe even leave a review if you're feeling generous. Until next time, this is Ethan Hansen reminding you that in this Wild West, the town is big enough for the two of us.